All right, welcome back to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. Good morning, of course, as well, if you've just joined us. Now, getting to some of your comments coming in so far this morning on a range of issues. Following recent reports of what's in our mortgage contracts, MICA homeowners, I'm horrified to read in my terms and conditions that damage caused by the defective blocks causes a default demand event on my mortgage contract. How have government and banks failed to address this? Why has government failed to make banks contribute to the redress scheme? That's the million-dollar question. It's a shame that stressed homeowners have to drive this initiative. Wouldn't you think banks would have held information nights to support MICA homeowners long ago? Maybe they're keeping low profile as they know the scheme won't fully fix houses, or they sit back and watch their assets be returned to full value either. They probably can't lose. Greg, on top of that assessment for dyslexia during exams, my son also had a separate assessment to see if he gets a reader. It's very unfair. No one would ask a child with a physical disability to be assessed every time he does something. Dyslexia may improve, but only slightly. It doesn't go away, they say. Another, I have dyslexia and did my Leaving Cert exam. I was isolated into a room and had an examiner watching over me, which I appreciate the work they were trying to facilitate me. However, it was the worst experience of my life. I felt as though more pressures were added, they say. They need to chat to people with dyslexia and ask them how they'd like the exams to go. Indeed, that would make an awful lot of sense. A caller says, time to forget the Eurovision. It's madness, flogging a dead horse. Yeah, I can see why some people might feel that. Hi, Greg. Could you wish Mary Ford a very happy birthday from all the staff at DPD? Happy to do that. And we'll take a break for the obituary. That's 2 days in a row. It's for the bingo numbers, of course. We'll take a break for the bingo numbers and then we'll be right back with Dr. Marie Hainsworth, who'll be joining us. She's manager of the Donegal Domestic Violence Services, to talk about a couple of high-profile cases that I'd imagine are really quite triggering for people. So we'll speak to her to see what best advice we can deliver to the public. Now, the next conversation is going to be about issues connected about domestic abuse and issues connected to it as well, just so you are aware before we begin. And I would say most of you are aware, if you're on social media, that the wife of a prominent Irish sports person has told of how she has been the victim of serious domestic violence for more than two decades. The woman said she was subjected to numerous vicious attacks by the sportsman over the past 24 years, including being beaten into an inch of her life, to quote her almost directly, strangled, bitten on the face and dragged by the hair along the street. Now, there's been much talk about this on social media. We are broadcast media and we are subject to much more stringent guidelines in terms of what we can say and what we can't say. And that goes for other. Often you will see posts or videos that appear on social media that we simply can't cover because we'd have to infer something or draw a conclusion, and that has to be substantiated and so on and so forth. So it's not that these stories are not talked about, it's just we are very much restrained in what we can say at certain times. That's the broadcast media. Social media, it seems to be a free-for-all. But Dr. Marie Hainsworth, manager of Donegal Domestic Violence Services, joins us on the programme. And I'm sure you, like the many, many thousands of others, read the testimony of this lady. And it is incredibly harrowing and worrying and just an incredibly difficult read. That doesn't talk to what it must have been like to go through it, Marie.
It is difficult, you know, and unfortunately, these are not incidences in isolation. I think most victims of domestic abuse don't put their story out there on social media. So sometimes, particularly when it's quite a prominent person, you know, the stories get read a lot more. There's a lot more distribution of the situation. The case was particularly extreme and over a long period of time. So, you know, I think, first of all, it's important to say that, you know, I think sometimes the cases can be so extreme that people almost shut off from it because they can't take it on board. And it is important that we continue having conversations around domestic abuse, even though sometimes the details are difficult. And also to remember that a lot of victims, like, we try and work with victims before it gets to that extent. So we're trying to encourage people to come forward. And I know, and I do appreciate that 20 years ago, the response would have been very different probably than what you'll get today. But we are encouraging that people do not stay in relationships that length of time and try and access supports. And I do appreciate they weren't probably available. at that particular time. But it's not the only story in the media, Greg, as you're probably aware. You know, there's been a number, you know, in terms of court reports of different situations and other aspects of domestic abuse which don't often get reported, such as the use of children within domestic violence settings, and how sometimes when the victim has actually moved on, the perpetrator will then turn their attention to, say, a substitute almost. And in that case, then the children can become the targets of domestic abuse. And unfortunately, the case was actually in Donegal, where a perpetrator of domestic abuse then abandoned a small child on the side of the road, and that was covered through the media there. So there are two elements here that are coming through in the media, and people might not think that they're connected, but actually they are all part of that spectrum of domestic abuse. And, you know, looking at the kind of the risk that imposes on victims, I think, you know, these are conversations we do need to have, however difficult they are.
Now, obviously, in terms of the severity or the actual actions that are taking place, they're going to vary case by case. But I would imagine there are victims of domestic abuse out there who are still trapped in that situation that will read through some of the key points. In other words, when it began, a decision maybe to stay in a relationship for what seemed like the right reasons at the time, how things progressed, the difficulty then in raising in getting out of that situation, and then often the consequences that can come along both personally and in your life around you from doing so. And I would say, as constructive as it is to have these conversations out in public, for some people at certain stages of their life, this is going to be very difficult for them to read. Have you any words for people that have found this, you know, that it's brought their own situation really to the fore in their minds?
Yeah, I would say I would encourage you to talk. You know, when I'm talking about general conversations, I think there's two different levels here. One is, I think it's important the public are talking about it all the time, because then there is an acceptance. Some people are, you know, when you're not in an abusive relationship, that's the time to kind of read up on domestic abuse and read up about, you know, what the different signs are. When you're in the middle of it, it can be very traumatic and you're not necessarily in a place where you can understand what's happening. So to have a support network around you of people who've done that work and who are aware of things and know where the contacts are and know who to speak to, that's the ideal situation that you want in terms of supporting victims, because most victims will talk to somebody they know and trust before they will contact anybody. And then certainly in terms of public figures, the first person they're likely to talk to is a GP. So that's, you know, the kind of avenue that you're looking at in terms of where referrals come in. It gets a bit more extreme when your first person you're talking to is a guard and it's a call out and it's emergency, because then you're throwing people into a situation and they're not really in a place to make decisions or be able to hear what people are saying to them. So it becomes very difficult dealing with very traumatized people and getting them to kind of think through situations. So that's what I'm talking about with general conversations and why people need to have them outside of the, you know, where we're reacting to major events or where, you know, getting very emotional about the stories we're reading. We do need to have a calm space where we can have these conversations.
Some of these cases which we've come across in recent times kind of hold a mirror up to organisations and society as a whole as to how this is all viewed to some extent.
Yeah, and I think, you know, with agencies, they have a different responsibility because, and I keep going on about this, I suppose, around risk assessment and the need to review risk assessment and the fact that once victims leave, you know, I've heard a lot of our clients say, oh, well, he is a good dad. We don't have any worries about the kids going there. But the reality is he was a good dad when the victim was present, or, you know, or the perpetrator was a good parent when the victim was present. When the victim's not there and they can't get access to the victim, then suddenly they are looking for another victim, or they're looking for a way to harm the victim through a third party. So, you know, risk assessment needs to be redone at that point. You know, social work can't assume, or anybody really, family can't assume that what happened before the separation is what's going to happen afterwards. You know, children do become the targets and do become pawns in that picture. Even without domestic abuse, you'll often see that in terms of divorce and separation, you know, but so you can imagine how much more it is when there's actually a desire by a perpetrator to control everything that's happening. So risk assessment is a big thing that agencies need to be looking at, a reassessment, an ongoing assessment, you know, so that we don't get some of the scenarios that we've had, certainly in the UK, where, you know, children have been killed on access And victims have been killed because agencies didn't get enough information or didn't share the right kind of information. And we are getting to learn more about that through the domestic homicide reviews, but we're not still not good at piecing together all the bits of information and sharing it across different agencies. And these cases now are getting so complicated, not one agency on its own can manage this. You know, we need to work together more.
Yeah, kind of touched on it, but what is your message to someone listening to this, maybe has been reading some of the coverage of the two cases that you talk of, and they are in an abusive relationship? You know, it could be emotional abuse, coercive control. It could be a physically abusive relationship. They're just waiting for the next, I don't know, big football match because they know what's coming next, sort of a thing. You know what I mean? Unfortunately, that's a sad reality of someone's life. What speak to them? What is your advice to them? What should they do first?
Well, talk to people, as I say, talk to ourselves as a service, and just run by the scenario. You know, we're not looking for extreme cases necessarily, but I think one of the things that was mentioned in the social media post there that people might have missed is she did reference that you assume abusers will change, but they never do. And the reality is, without some kind of an intervention, no, their behaviour is not going to change. They don't have any reason to change. So sitting back and hoping that the situation will change and become better is unlikely to happen. And the other common myth I think that people have is that the children were not present, as in they weren't in the room when something happened, and so therefore it doesn't have an impact on them. And, you know, we know from talking to children who've lived through domestic abuse, they absolutely hear everything and they understand everything, and they pick up on the dynamics, they pick up on the tensions, and they pick up on the fear. So whatever you're experiencing as an adult victim, you can be guaranteed that the children are experiencing their own version of that. And are being affected. So the longer you stay in that situation, the greater the impact it has. And also the greater the opportunity you're giving the perpetrator to isolate you, to cut you off from supports, and to even meet some of those supports like family and give them a story and a version of events that will make it harder for you to be able to disclose what's happening. So don't delay, you know, let's start the move, you know, do it safely, you know, choose a time when you're on your own, pick up the helpline, talk to somebody. There's no going to be no pressure from us that you have to leave a relationship. Mm. We can certainly support you through it.
And I suppose there is going to be a right time, but it might feel that there's never going to be a right time. But obviously the right time, a person is probably going to have to exit that scenario at some point, or God forbid something very serious might happen. If you can face it early, before, you know, there is extreme violence or a child is put at risk. Because as I say, it's probably a journey someone is going to have to go through at some point in any case.
It is, and unfortunately, there's not necessarily going to be an easy way around it. And I think people do kind of hold back, hoping that things will change, and that's unlikely to happen. So, yeah, embrace it as soon as you realize you don't deserve to be treated like this. Nobody does, and your children certainly don't deserve to be treated. But even if there aren't children there, you as an adult don't deserve to be treated that way. So, you know, there doesn't have to be children involved. We work with what we would call families anyway, regardless of the situation. So, you know, don't wait and don't assume it'll just resolve itself, because it won't.
How important is it, the public response to cases? I'm not talking about any specific cases, but obviously you have people that will express their sympathy. You'll have others that say nothing, and but then there is a group of people that will victim blame. That seems to be their default position, without maybe thinking of how. Well, I don't need to extend it beyond that, just to say that there does seem to be quite a large group of people that are the first thing they'll want to do is victim blame.
And I think it's important to understand that victim blaming is probably a defence mechanism, because what it does is it puts a bit of distance between saying that couldn't happen to me, it happened to them because. Because if you don't do that, the other thing you have to face up to is, well, it could happen to me or it could happen to somebody I know. So it is about understanding. That's why I'm saying we kind of need to have conversations in calm environments where we're not reacting to things, where we can actually process things and look at it a bit more kind of objectively. And the other thing is, so not to get tied into those discussions or arguments. If that's where the person's at, they're not going to be able to hear you.
Yeah, you're not going to change their mind, yeah.
Yeah, but the main thing the public can do is to keep this issue live, so that, you know, like the Department of Justice that has that responsibility to fund and protect victims and protect the services that support victims, that they keep this live as an issue that they need to be supporting. Because it's very easy, you know, in terms of government, things can fall off the agenda, other things take priority. we just need to make sure that doesn't happen.
Not exclusively, but for the most part, domestic violence, maybe even particularly physical domestic violence, is perpetrated by men. And maybe there's some awareness amongst the general male population that this is going on. It could be language in WhatsApp groups, or it could just be knowing something has happened but saying nothing. Is it important that it's called out, or like what role do men as a whole do you think have in relation to calling out that kind of toxicity, that type of behaviour? Is it significant, or would it make any difference?
No, I think it is significant, you know, and a lot of men are parents, you know, and you're going to come to situations where your child's wanting to play with another child who might well be in a domestic abuse situation, you know. So if you, you know, you're always going to be faced with this issue, even if it's not in your own relationship. You're going to have family members, you're going to, you know, some people will have been grown up in this environment. So I think it is important that, you know, men probably hear it better from men, that you can challenge and say, you know, you don't need to be abusive to make a relationship work. You know, your relationship with your child is should be parented properly. You know, that there's all sorts of things that dads do to support other dads that can be done. And challenge and abuse within that is one of those things. You know, that there's, I think sometimes in the past, you know, in terms of fathers' rights, there has been this kind of lump all men together as fathers. But actually, I think it's important to differentiate. There are good dads, and then there are abusive perpetrators, and there needs to be separation of that, because children do deserve access to both parents. They don't deserve to be made unsafe and have access to perpetrators if that's what they don't want, you know. So it's about trying to break down that these things go beyond gender and beyond stereotypes. Now we are specifically focusing on abusive parents towards children, that we're challenging that behavior and not afraid to do it publicly. You know, I think in the past we wouldn't have challenged what we saw happening in a supermarket or on the street, but it doesn't have to be violent, you know, but I think there is a need to take more interest in what's happening around us.
If an accusation was made against me along these lines and I was part of an organization or an institution, do you have a view as to how best that institution or organization might deal with me?
There are lots of workplace policies coming in around domestic
abuse. But I'm on about in terms of instant reaction. But should I be left in my position? Should I be suspended from my position with a presumption of innocence until such time as the situation becomes more clear? I mean, is there an appropriate response from an organisation to deal with someone like me if those accusations were made against me?
And it does depend on the situation, because some organisations, you might have both the victim and the perpetrator working in the same organisation. So obviously in that situation, you're going to have to be a lot more proactive than if you're just working with one or the other. We've certainly done a lot of work with employees or employers around supporting victims and allowing them time off to go to court and to go through the process. That can be quite timely. Then you've got to consider the other side in terms of once a perpetrator, like sometimes the cases can take years to come to court. So, you know, organizations are going to have to look through their policies about their public reputation and the role of the person as well. Like if the role of that person is a frontline guard dealing with domestic violence cases, you might view that very differently than if they're, you know, working in a store away from the public.
I understand. Yeah. Do you organize, when there are high profile conversations or court cases, do organizations like yours, Donegal Domestic Violence Services, does that be reflected on in contacts in terms of phone calls, texts, emails, or what have you?
Sometimes, and it depends what the trigger things are within whatever has come up. I know certainly that you remember the domestic homicide that happened in Monaghan. So that definitely triggered a lot of things for people, because there was no physical violence in the run-up to that case, and we went from a coercive controlling environment into a domestic homicide. And I think that really hit home, and a lot of people became quite alarmed because they hadn't realised that maybe that was one of the pathways in terms of domestic homicide, that there doesn't necessarily have to be a precursor of physical violence before there is actual homicide. So other cases, not necessarily the people are already working on those issues. I would say in terms of that social media post, there was an issue there where she talked about strangulation. And that is a huge red flag for us, because that is definitely a red flag in terms of leading up to a domestic homicide. So if anybody is in a domestic violence relationship and thinks, well, there's been no physical violence, but he did try to strangle me once, that is, you know, you've already leapt up several steps on the ladder of concern. So definitely to contact the service if that's happened.
Yeah, well, that's evidence and experience based as well. That's why I think you've put so much evidence in that. And I think it's, has it, or is it going to be an offence in and of itself? I think that law was passed, wasn't it, Marie?
Yeah, and certainly as in Northern Ireland, I think non-fatal strangulation is the definition
that's
of it.
Correct,
looking for that to become its own crime. And that's the problem with domestic abuse. There is no crime with domestic abuse. It's always, you know, it's either a physical assault or it's a sexual assault or it's stalking or harassment. And hopefully, now the non-fatal strangulation would be another aspect to it. So, you know, domestic violence is very complex and complicated as an issue. And it's always useful to talk through it with somebody else.
I'll only keep you 30 seconds, but this text came in and I just want to put it to you. And I don't understand, I don't really get it. When we're talking about the experience of predominantly women and what they have to go through, that men get defensive. I don't understand why people think that, well, women do it too. I mean, we know that, right? But we're talking about the majority of this type of violence is men on women. And it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen in reverse and it doesn't belittle what happens to those people, but people get very defensive of it. And people said, this text says, it's always the same men, men, men. You'd think women were not capable of same or worse, but we're simply not saying that. Are we, Marie? We're talking about the largest, what we see for the most part, but it doesn't in any way suggest it doesn't happen in the other direction or to lessen the experience who's been through that. That's, you know, they're not competing priorities here.
No, and I think, but when you look at statistics in terms of certainly domestic homicide reviews, where multi-agencies are sitting down and reviewing them in the UK at the moment, the vast majority of victims would be female, the vast majority of perpetrators would be male. Sometimes, particularly where you've got mental health and you've got addiction, those lines can get blurred in terms of you might get victims who retaliate and actually are the ones that end up causing the homicide. So it's a complicated relationship. And what's particularly complicated, I think, as we move into an older population, is you've got adult children versus, you know, against their parents. So you've got older population there as well. So no, it's not about saying that it's only men who are violent, but the vast majority of violent perpetrators of domestic abuse are men, you know, and that's just statistically how it stands at the moment. Not that I want it to change, you know, we're trying to reduce the number.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it doesn't mean that we don't recognise other things happen as well. Okay. Dr. Marie Hainsworth, thank you for just finally the contact details. If anyone's listened to this conversation and having a conversation with the likes of the Donegal Domestic Violence Service does not necessarily trigger a chain of events. It doesn't mean a squad car is going to pull up outside the house necessarily. It's about having a conversation and getting some initial support and talking things through. I think I've described it correctly. You can correct me where I'm wrong. But if someone just wants a conversation, how do they get in contact?
Well, the helpline number is an 1800 number, 1800-262677, or the landline equivalent is 074-912-6267. And it's available there for family as well. So, you know, if you're concerned about a family member, we have had lots of family people contact us, and we've had family members from outside the country call us with concerns about family members in Donegal. So, you know, it's there and it's available. We also have the Facebook page, the Messenger, or you can email us on ddvsrefuge. At gmail.com. So, you know, put down in writing what it is that you want to chat about.
All right. Have a lovely day, Marie. Thanks so much for helping us cover these issues. Dr. Marie Hainsworth, Manager of Donegal Domestic Violence Services. Neglect by successive governments has put the defence and security of our country in peril. That's according to former Garda Sergeant Christy Galligan, who joins us on the programme now. Christy, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, then.
All right, okay, so expand out on the points that you're making to us a little bit more, please, Christy. Yeah.
Well, it really was the Commission on the Defence Forces report in 2022 showed that we are defenceless on land, sea and air. It's rogue states like Russia wanted to invade, all right? And we are really a very weak part of the defence of Europe, should I say. Well, we're reliant on our nearest neighbour, the UK, to thwart any threats under an agreement that was signed in 1952, which is considered today by, I think, Gerard Crockle as unconstitutional, and that should have went to a referendum and for the people to decide. So we are in a situation where their defence capabilities are very weak. We only spend something like 0.2% of GDP. compared to other neutral countries, it's a very small minimal amount. We've heard about the playing conditions within the forces itself, but we have 8 aircraft, one of which is a pilot's PC-9, and 2 Eurocopters. None of these have the capabilities to intercept something like a Tupolev bomber, which is up at 35 to 40,000 feet. We rely on the British army or the defence forces to intercept using Typhoons to intercept, and they come from Scotland once they detect it on their system to come in and escort these bombers or other fighters from our international. We've had 2 situations recently where, in 2020, where 2 Russian Tupolev bombers, Tu-95 aircraft, were twice entered Irish controlled airspace and had to be escorted out by RAF. This shows you how weak we are in relation to our own sovereignty. And we also have the issue of Russian warships off the coast of Ireland, which, and true reflection, shows how dangerous Russia has become. And it could be interfering with underwater cables, we don't know, because we were reliant on other countries to come to our aid.
But in reality, Christy, we are military neutral. Clearly, we're not politically neutral any longer. We've been dragged into this by the leaders of the countries. But in reality, no matter what we spend, given the size and population of this country, we could never really put any defence up if the Russians or whomever were to take a notion to launch some sort of a salvo against Europe from the island of Ireland. There's no defence really we could offer in any case. How many planes would it take? How many anti-aircraft missiles would it take? How many boats would it take for it to be in any way meaningful to justify the expense?
Well, they're saying that from the Commissioner of Defence Forces stated that the Irish Air Corps needs to acquire an air combat and intercept capability. They would require a squadron of new aircraft like the Typhoon, 12 to 24 aircraft, to justify us ensuring the safety of the skies over Irish jurisdiction. And that's what we need. We have, would you believe it, we have a defence capability that is virtually obsolete. A giraffe radar system, which is used to guide the defence forces on limited ground-based air defence systems, is considered obsolete. We have Fennell 70 anti-air cannons, RB-70s, and things like that there that the defence forces say are now no longer usable and are most likely extinct. So I think, really, when we look at the Irish Naval Service, we had 6 boats tied up because they can't get the crews to crew them. Yet we're going to send one of them off to Libya. Another problem is we have our army on the ground who are constantly crying about pay and conditions, who have been under-resourced for many, many, many years. And that's from successive governments, unfortunately, because we use the neutrality thing as a kind of a buffer for everything. We see what neutrality did or sovereignty did in Ukraine. We have neutral countries like Sweden or Nordic countries like Sweden and Finland who have signed up to NATO. Even though they were neutral, they're signing up as a defence against that. That doesn't stop us from doing that. We're sitting on a UN Security Council, which can be vetoed. Anything we bring forward can be vetoed by one of the aggressors, which is Russia. Russia, who is the chair of the UN Security Council at the present moment in time. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Has the biggest threat to Irish airspace, though, over the last 40 or 50 years not been from British military aircraft in the skies above the Republic of Ireland, not Russian aircraft, for crying out loud?
But funny enough, we allowed the incursion of military aircraft in because of this agreement in 1952, which has been challenged in the High Court by Senator Jerry Crothwell. And we have allowed them, and during the Troubles, as we called it, to come in over the border up to 5 miles. So it has always been there. There's been this agreement between both governments that the UK, because we don't have the capabilities anyway, we don't have the capabilities anyway to defend ourselves anyway if something happened. We rely on British RAF to come in here over our skies. But what they cannot do unless an officer of the Irish Air Corps gives, or an officer in the Defence Force gives the okay. What they cannot do is shoot another plane down. All they can do is escort the aggressors.
Is it not the case, though, in reality, that we are not going to be necessarily the targets of any sort of activity, that it probably would be Britain or France or whomever? You know, we are neutral. Let's maintain that neutrality. In fact, I think we should be exploiting that neutrality on the world stage, particularly given the success of the Good Friday Agreement for the most part. You know, rather than tooling up and aligning ourselves all the more with, you know, the likes of you know, mainland Europe and Britain, that we should actually, you know, be proud of the status that we have. And if the RAF want to use our airspace to thwart off any threat to mainland Britain, then let them do so. But why should we be pumping money into it?
But as you said yourself, I mean, neutrality is kind of aspirational for us. It's not set in stone. And what you've already said is we're no longer neutral. Technically, we're no longer neutral because we have supported Ukraine regarding defence. We have supported others in relation to it, in relation to European policy. What we could do really at the end of the day is we have PESCO and the common defence policies that if we signed up to them in relation to hybrid, and the definitely cyber security and hybrid security is very, very important as well. We don't have the equipment and to deploy against any attacks or any real attacks at the end of the day. I find it extraordinary that while the Russian warships are off the west coast of Ireland, probably interfering with the underwater cables, we don't know that yet for a fact, but they are being looked at, that we have a naval service that cannot deploy all of its vessels at any one time to ensure that our waters are safe at the present moment in time.
Well, I suppose when you pay pittance to the army, members of the army, whereby effectively our navy is just a training vessel where people work for a while and then go on to other things, to the point where these boats are tied up because they literally can't staff them, and they'll claim they're in for servicing, but the bottom line is they can't staff them. We've a long way to go. You have to start at the bottom, pay people the right amount of money.
But yes, I totally agree with you, Greg. I absolutely agree with you there on that. The pay and conditions within the Defence Force is abominable and has been for many years. And we've treated our Defence Force personnel, who should be credited with the great work they're doing in peacekeeping, they should first and foremost be paid proper and be treated not as second-class citizens, which I always said that the Defence Forces have been treated as second-class citizens. And a lot of those people who are deployed, I hear from family members who have to go to food banks, etc., or have to get extra social welfare payments because the payments they get from within the Defence Forces has not helped either. And that's why you see so many people resigning from the Defence Forces. We have people from the Air Corps who resign after we trained up on training aircraft, because that's most of what we have. Those 8 aircraft, most of them are just training aircraft, not really interceptors or anything else. They wouldn't be able to withstand a MiG-29 or...
No, certainly if it flew above 25,000 feet, they couldn't. So finally then, I mean, obviously, reading through your letter, it's a state of play. It's where we're at and how we got here. So finally, the question is, Christy, what do you believe should be done? Do you believe that we should be increasing our investment in the armed forces, that we should be buying in modern plane, training pilots for them, increasing our naval fleet, having them fully serviced? Do you believe that that's where money nowadays in Ireland should be spent?
Well, as I listened to the Minister for Expenditure and also for Finance say that they have extra money in the bin, they could use that money to update and pay our Defence Forces, but update the equipment that the Defence Forces doesn't have. I think that's the way to go if we are to have any chance of ensuring our own security and safety.
Okay, but I get exactly what you're saying, but let's take Ukraine for an example, a country that had an army that knew after Crimea was annexed, they knew the Russians were coming back. They had years and years to prepare for it. But the reality is that if it wasn't for the Western intervention, they would have been wiped out in 2 days. I think it's $170 billion the Americans have pumped in, a further $25 billion the EU has pumped in. And still, all it is and it's a horrible phrase, but at the moment, all that's happening is it's a meat churner for both young Russian and young Ukrainian men. And it's worth remembering, by the way, that a lot of the Ukrainian men involved in this, they're conscripted. They have no choice. They can't leave, and they are sent to the front lines, probably to die. I don't think an awful lot of people realise that these young men fighting, young men for the most part, are actually conscripts. They've got no choice. They are sent to the front line. And if they don't do that, the penalties are incredibly, incredibly severe. So it's not just the Russians doing that, the Ukrainians are doing that. But my point being, with all the knowledge of what was coming, with all the preparation, they still would have been wiped out in a day or two if it wasn't for billions upon billions, multiple hundreds of billions being pumped in there just to keep Russia to the east. So what's the point in us wasting any money and risking young Irish lives in offering any defence? Let's head out to Merva Beach, Rosnaula Beach, and just wave our white flags or wave them across our heads and say Britain's behind us.
Yeah, but the problem with that analogy is that we could raise our white flags and say, no, we're neutral, you know, there's nothing to be seen here. Does that matter a whit to people like Vladimir Putin? Certainly not. You know, I mean, this guy has been in charge of one of the biggest defense forces in the world. Yes, he wasn't satisfied to live a sovereign state alone. He came in, he demolished parts of it, of the state that he wanted to take over. He has demolished it. He's killed hundreds of thousands. There have been serious war crimes. Do you think he would have anything different for Ireland?
But do you certainly think we not. Could really put up any meaningful defence? And I think kind of we're at a stalemate there. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't believe we can put up any defence at the present moment in time when you see how bad we are in relation to our spend. There's 0.2% of GDP on spend on the defence forces. No, we couldn't. We couldn't. But at least that if you have updated equipment and you have what is required under the Defence Force Commission, the report on the Defence Force Commission, we need to look at how we are going to reduce the threat from...
Well, one way we could reduce the threat is the leaders of this country who don't have the mandate to play with our supposed neutrality is to not antagonise the greatest potential threat. And we got a direct threat to Ireland from Russia.
Yes.
And because of, I think it was Micheál Martin's comments about a person who chose to travel from Ireland and fight for Ukraine, and off the back of Micheál Martin's comments, we got a direct threat that if we meddle, then we can face all the consequences of that.
But I think threats like that, we know from the Russian embassy and Russia itself. You know, threats like that are we must take seriously as well. But they are threats to our sovereignty. And if we cannot defend our sovereignty in some meaningful way, other than just by words alone, then we're no longer a sovereign nation.
Okay. Well, I would like us to use our sovereignty as peacemakers, personally speaking. I don't want my sons or anyone's sons or any person from this county or this region to be dragged into someone else's war. But anyway,
I
respect your views and I appreciate you sharing them with us. What do you think out there? 086 60 25,000. Okay, some quick reaction to our last conversation coming in. Who would want to take this country? We can't even agree north and south. The Russian ships are only here to spy on the UK, nothing else. That being said, there is some concern. They are looking to interfere with those communication lines. Another caller says, Russia will never bother Ireland if our government mind their own business, and we the people don't give our government any right to change this either. Another, has Ireland become more paranoid? There was never discussions on Ireland's warfaring a few years ago. Don't promote current proxy wars if required. The pikemen will return. Okay. I think there's always been a conversation about our position in various conflicts. There was a lot of conversation that continues about the use of Shannon for the invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan. In the Second World War, we allowed British planes to flying out of Fermanagh, I believe it was, to fly over Irish airspace. I think for generations, the conversation about our neutrality or our role, either directly or indirectly in various conflicts, has been there. This is just the latest wave of it. But I think there's sort of more of a conversation now about a European army and what have you. Hi, Greg. In relation to those temporary speed limits, I agree fully with Colm. Move the sign or add another flashing sign. It's unreasonable the way it is, which seems to be a consensus out there. Ireland doesn't do well in the Eurovision because they're so far up the Brits. You know what Brits are hated all over the world, and Sinn Féin winning and whining and dining with people who put our Republicans in the grave. They're a disgrace to the Irish peoples. I'm not really sure those the people watching and voting on the Eurovision are perhaps get all the nuances of politics here. The sign from the Newton side is never on. Back to that issue we talked about earlier. There was a queue of 50 people at Dunn's today, says this listener. Is this Dunn's in Letterkenny? I was so shocked to hear what they were queuing for. It's a drink. They found it on TikTok. It's called Prime. Absolutely ridiculous. It's a phenomenon, this Prime thing. There's a couple of YouTubers that are responsible for it. They've created this drink. They are making an absolute fortune. I think it's just an energy drink. I've never tasted it. But people do queue and pay a fortune for cans of this drink called Prime. It's just a regular drink. There's nothing fancy in it. And as I say, it's got one of the Logan brothers behind it and KSI is behind it. And they're pushing it on their YouTube channels. That's where all the young people are, unfortunately. They're not listening to me, I don't think. Not in mass, although we've got some great news in that regard coming up a little later on today. But anyway, I can't say anything else. All I know is that I'm not young anymore. I don't get it. But the young ones are mad for this Prime drink, particularly, I think, because of who is backing and pushing it. OK, back with more after the break. We'll get the news at 11 for you.